Hello and welcome to this episode of the Star Wars Universe Podcast. Today I'm joined by Riki and Sarah Hayashi as we're getting back to Star Wars Rebels. We're talking about Season 1, Episodes 3, 4, and hopefully Episode 5, depending on how long we take discussing the other two. All that and more after this commercial break we have no control over. Back. I'm Matthew, your host, and joined, as I said, by Riki and Sarah. We're going to be getting back into kind of the regular covering Rebels, hopefully pretty much, not exactly every week, but pretty close, trying to get as much of Rebels in as we can before we start the Book of Boba in December. How you two doing today?
Good.
Always excited for Rebels. Always.
Yeah. Awesome. What's kind of your overall thought on the three episodes we're going to dive into today?
They're good. It's very good television. Yeah. I guess I have some questions, concerns about, like, why are we getting these characters, certain characters, mm-hmm. so early on in the series?
Right.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about the fun throwbacks that we're seeing. And, yeah, like, I love all of Rebels. These episodes are no exception to that. How about you?
In some ways, I feel like these episodes are the best test of why I like this show so much because, you know, when we did The Clone Wars, we talked about how there are some amazing episodes, really good episodes, but then there's some kind of eye-rolly ones that you got to get through.
Mm-hmm.
Episodes like the ones that we did today are probably not any of them on my favorites list. You know, I think these are kind of, each of them drop some interesting things into the story, but they're pretty forgettable episodes, I think, in a lot of ways. And the fact that, like, the bottom tier, maybe, or the middle tier of episodes of the show are still quite good, is to me just a very, like, okay, yeah, this is a show that has just a very strong amount of consistency across the board.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really fair. I mean, other shows, you know, some people advise that you skip the entire first season or something. And right. Actually, like, our friend who recommended this show, not you, another friend, did say that it started off slow, and we just didn't have that experience. And I think, yeah, these episodes overall, if you look at the entire series, are on the weaker end, but they're still not bad.
Yeah, the bar is high for Rebels. Yeah. And I think, like, the skippable first season, like, for me, Star Trek Next Generation always comes to mind for that, because the first two mm-hmm. seasons are quite bad. But the rest of the show is good. So, like, having a skippable first season, I don't think necessarily makes for a bad show. But
oh, for sure.
It's just nice that, yeah, that's not really even necessary with Rebels here.
Mm-hmm. So let's dive into the episodes themselves. We start first with Droids in Distress. And we all know how much the three of us love droid episodes. Said with a bit of sarcasm, because Sarah is very much a droid fan, I think.
I did a little dance.
Riki and I can be at somewhat different points. And let me just give you a quick plot summary. The episode features the crew of the Ghost intercepting a shipment of weapons intended for the Galactic Empire. Along the way, they inadvertently pick up C-3PO and R2-D2, who are on a secret mission from Senator Bail Organa to prevent the weapons from falling into Imperial hands. The Rebels continue to be chased by Agent Kallus of the Imperial Security Bureau, while Gerazeb Aurelius, better known to us as Zeb, deals with grief over the near extinction of his people. In the end, R2-D2 provides Organa, who will become one of the founders of the Alliance to restore the Republic, with information about the Rebels and their activities. So which kind of your overall thoughts on this episode?
I mean, as you mentioned, I like droid episodes. No surprise, uh-huh. I liked this episode. I loved the, not throwbacks, the, like, nods we got to the ride at Disneyland Star Tours, was just super fun, and that we get this instant throwback to two very beloved staples of the series, R2 and 3PO, while still focusing on, like, our core cast of characters here in, like, this, yeah, episode 3, but 1 and 2 I think were shown as, like, a really mm-hmm. long first episode, as we talked about last time. Yeah.
I'm always happy to see C-3PO and R2-D2, just because, like, I enjoy those characters. This is much more a problem with the prequels, but, like, there's just so much that we're showing those droids happen, that it doesn't make any sense that they didn't remember that by the time we get to the New Hope movies. That, like, I think I would have preferred if it had been some other droids, but I felt like the series needed to do things to hook, like, the Star Wars viewers, you know? Like, to have a little, like, yes, don't worry, we are going to be pretty keyed into stuff from the movies that you know and love. And so that, I think for me, that wasn't my favorite part. It kind of maybe questioned some things, but in the end, not a huge deal. And the idea of, like, well, but why were C-3PO and R2-D2 knowing this? Well, we already have that question in spades right now.
Yeah, well, and I buy into the idea that, like, 3PO's had his memory wiped a few times, at mm-hmm. least. And, like, R2 knows everything and is saying stuff with his beeps and whistles that just we don't understand. So it's, like, it's easy for me to, like, hand wave away the fact that, like, mm-hmm. these two are everywhere. But, yeah, I totally agree that we kind of need, like, an anchor to hold us onto the Star Wars universe and, like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, build around.
Yeah, so the problem I have here is yeah, introducing 3PO and R2 as this hook. For me at least, they are not, like, beloved enough to draw me in this way, especially for, like, this franchise. There are other characters that they bring in from, you know, Clone Wars or from the movies that get that gasp, like, oh my god, it's that character, and you know, we'll talk about those in the future. But these two are just not central enough for me. I mean, well, Sarah's making a gasping face. What I mean is, like, in terms of the galactic conflict, right, they have always just been sidekicks that are there, like, they do important things, and there's this argument that R2-D2 is the living embodiment of the Force because, as you said, his memory is not erased. He knows everything and seems to, like, be in the right place at the right time, quote-unquote, accidentally, like, saving the day. 3PO, I am very much less enthused about, especially in this episode, because as we get into it, they seem to have not told him the mission.
Would you tell 3PO the mission?
And he just, like, bumbles about.
Yeah, he's R2-D2's sidekick. I don't know. The fact that, like, 3PO introduces R2 as, like, my counterpart, R2-D2, like, yeah, 3PO is, like, the kid that mom told R2 to be nice to and drag around to parties.
3PO is, like, Inspector Gadget.
Yes.
And yeah. R2 is Penny and Brain actually solving the cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. I think for me, part of it is that this show has introduced Chopper, who is in and of himself such an interesting character as a droid that I kind of feel like less of a need for these characters. And I think it especially feels weird because in some ways, like, when I think of this episode, what I think about are all that we learn about Lasat, and about the Lasat, Zeb's people, and Zeb himself, and Agent Kallus's role in that. We're going to get introduced to Senator Bail Organa, who, if you're a fan of the prequels, you might remember that's the role that Jimmy Smits was playing, and certainly a big part of the Clone Wars is one of the senators who is not really down with things, and he kind of has to escape the Jedi Temple, but is clearly not happy about what's happening. And we know that he's the one who takes Leia and raises her, hence her becoming the Princess of Alderaan. Mm-hmm. I wish I knew what his... I don't quite understand the royal family of Alderaan, but that's not for this story. But yeah, I mean, like, I kind of forget that, like, actually the episode is kind of about C-3PO and R2-D2 bumbling their way through these adventures when all they really care about is the adventures that are happening.
I don't really know if I agree that it's about them. Like, ostensibly, I think if you were to be like, hey, yeah, here it's like 3PO and R2-D2 are doing stuff, and then there's this other thing going on in the background. But I think it's kind of, like, when you think about it, it's the opposite. Like, there is this sort of loose framework that we can kind of, like, build off of. But they're not the main story. And, yeah, like, we don't follow them around afterwards. We don't get to see what happens once they get returned to Bail Organa or anything like that. They're just, like, I don't know. It's like a fun cameo.
So, terms of cameo, what really excited me much more was the pilot droid of the starship that they are on. It's RX-24, and as Sarah mentioned earlier, this whole episode is kind of based around the Star Tours ride And yeah. the droid RX-24 is the pilot droid of the original ride. And the voice actor for that ride, it reprises the role here. And it's Paul Reubens, a.k.a. Pee-wee Herman. Which is yeah. just a fascinating thing to have in Star Wars, right?
Have you all gone on that ride?
Yes, multiple times.
Well, it's changed.
I've been on the old version and the new version, yeah.
Yeah, I went on it once, probably 30 years ago, 25 years ago, when I was a kid. Like, it was like 16, 17, or maybe even earlier than that, when I went to California and Disneyland. And so I imagine it was the old version, but I didn't put together that it was the same voice, because you don't remember that, but I definitely got that feel, and I'm not surprised at all to realize it's the same person.
Yeah, I think it's really fun that they got the same actor. That's super cool. But yeah, even just having that sort of premise of like, welcome to Star Tours. This is the model of droid, at the very least, who's going to be piloting this model of ship. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the big plot points that kind of come up here. So first of all, we learn about Zeb, and we learn that his people, the Lasat, were almost completely decimated. Basically, it seems kind of like the Alderaanians or the Alderaanians. I don't know how you say that. Yeah. The people from Alderaan. You know, the people who are not on world, the off-worlders, lived, but the planet itself was pretty much wiped out. And we learned that Agent Kallus was actually, like, the person who was in charge of that.
Yeah.
And, like, last time we were saying, like, okay, he seems like kind of a fun guy, even though he's an Imperial. But then in the end, he, like, kicks a stormtrooper off a ledge and kills him. And we're like, okay, so he's not perfect. Now we've moved from, like, he killed one stormtrooper to, like, genocidal maniac, you know? I mean, this is, like, a dark man.
Yeah. I think, like, fun is an interesting adjective in that, like, I still think he's fun, but not in the, like, I don't think he's a good person, right?
Right.
Like, he's an interesting character. I really like the character as far as, like, I'm really interested in the character and seeing where he goes. I think he's very well developed. But yeah, not someone I'd want to, like, pal around with or anything like that.
Yeah, this, like, continues to add to his menace as the primary antagonist to this point.
For sure. I think, at least for me, I think it kind of confirmed it. Like, after the first couple episodes, especially watching him with the Inquisitor, I kind of had the feeling of him as kind of a cog in the machine who wanted, like, order and thought he was doing what was best, but maybe he isn't thrilled about the excesses of the Empire, and maybe he's going to be a little bit of our, you know, sympathetic character within the Empire. Nope. That's certainly not the case anymore.
Yeah. He's definitely a major player within, or at least has influence within the Empire, especially on Lothal, which is the planet that we seem to be centering around.
Right.
It's Ezra's home planet. And and the fact that he's taken a weapon of, was it like the Lasat Royal Guard?
I think so, yeah.
And is using that, and like Zeb recognizes, like, you're not, there's like an emotional significance to that weapon. It's not just like picking up a random sword, like you need to be able to earn it. And Kallus is using it. Zeb calls him out and he's like, oh, I know, I took it when I murdered all your friends and family.
It's called a bow rifle.
Right. Which I think is, he's obviously a different character, but Zeb is somewhat of a Chewbacca stand-in, and Chewbacca has the crossbow rifle, the bowcaster, I think it's called, and so I do think that that is very intentional, that he has a similar kind of weapon.
Yeah, well, they make the joke in one of the first two episodes about him being a hairless Wookiee, and like...
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. he is sort of like, he's the muscle, right? Which I guess Chewbacca was as well.
And I feel like this is also an important moment for him, because till now, all we've really learned about him is that he's the kind of grumpy one who was kind of willing to let Ezra behind and doesn't seem like as welcoming to Ezra as everyone else. And I feel like getting this side of him and understanding, like, just how much pain and trauma he's been through and why he's in this fight, and maybe has the kind of most cynical attitude of everyone on the crew, like, it really fills in his character a lot.
Yeah. So, okay, I guess getting into the plot a little bit, right? Like, the weapons that they are trying to stop from going to the Imperials, didn't those also have something to do with the destruction of Lasat? Or am I making that up? Yeah. Disruptors? Yeah, okay. Yeah, so that's, like, part of it. Which I guess, like R2-D2 and, like, our cast of characters both have a similar objective, which is prevent these disruptors from getting into Imperial hands. Right? It's just, like, the Rebels want to sell them to a third party so that they can get a few credits to help along along the way. Whereas R2, D2, and 3PO want to just return them to Bail or destroy them, right?
And I think that's the other thing that, kind of moving along a little bit, that I really love about this episode is that we now have, like, until now all we knew is that, like, this one group of people on this one ship was trying to, like, harass the Empire a little bit.
Yeah.
And now we at least know that, like, there's some larger groups who are kind, like, Ghost is a little connected to them, but not really. But, like, there's some other groups out there that are doing similar kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There's a more concerted effort than just these folks. For sure. Yeah. Although, like, the Rebels don't learn about Bail. They never meet or hear. Well, they meet, but they don't get his name, right?
Yeah, we, the audience, find out about it. But
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And so they end up blowing up the disruptors as a way of taking down some of the walkers that are coming towards. Like, this is in this conflict where Zeb and Callus are arguing at the boat rifle and fighting each other. Blow up some disruptors to get rid of some chicken walkers. Ezra ends up using the Force to push back Callus and save Zeb. Which is neat because we haven't seen, like, we've seen Ezra, like, open the holocron, but we haven't seen him, like, use the Force in this way before. And I think, like, Zeb thanks Freddie Prinze Jr. I just blanked on his name. Kanan, thank you. Thanks Kanan for it. And Kanan's like, not me. It was this kid who you wanted to leave behind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's some great plot moments there and further development with the characters. I think one of the reasons why I got so excited about Organa and the Rebels showing up is I love the beginnings of things, you know, and especially one of the things that I think is most interesting is a story about when this empire is so overwhelmingly powerful and, you know, resistance has been pretty much crushed. How is it that, like, the one or two little people who start to think maybe there could be something different, find each other and inspire each other and start to build something and it becomes something? And so this to me was like, oh, maybe we're actually going to get to kind of see the formation of the Rebel Alliance in some way or another. So I think it was just like that. It was one more thing where this episode was like, okay, cool. I really like where this show is going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like that we're seeing it sort of tangentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what about and then we also meet two characters, Minister Tua and Governor Price. What were your kind of thoughts on those two?
Yeah, so these are political officials of Lothal, who are, like, in the Empire's pocket, pretty much.
I mean, for one thing, it's good to see women in Star Wars in general.
Yep.
But also, like, specifically women in positions of power within the Empire, because the original, you know, trilogy, A New Hope through Return of the Jedi, just showed so much of, like, this white male-centric thing. And that's become kind of the lore of Star Wars and the Empire, that they are a human supremacist organization, and that the Rebel Alliance is, like, this group of all of the other alien species. But there has also been criticism, you know, about the misogyny of the Empire and not having women in positions. And that's been written about a lot in Legends, specifically with the character of Admiral Dalla, who was, like, one of the few women to rise to the position of Admiral. And so to see Governor Price, you know, a governor of this entire planet, and then Minister Tua as well, like, I think is very important for Star Wars.
I can totally see that. Yeah, I think I like that they're women. I like just kind of getting to see more of the bureaucracy, because it's kind of the other side of the what I was saying about the formation of the Rebels. Like, for so much of the Star Wars movies, we only are really seeing what's happening at the very top level. You know, we hear references to the Senate that gets dissolved, and then, of course, is still in the prequels. They make reference to the Imperial governors will now have power. But we never actually really see how that happens. And right. I'm just really interested in seeing, especially because we have these two different figures, you know, seeing how they're going to interact with each other. And there's a great, like, very funny set of scenes about the minister not being able to translate with the I think it's a Celestin who she's working with, and the Chopper and Sabine trying to, like, help translate, and in so doing, you know, stealing their plans and mucking them around. So it was a really fun episode for that, but also just, I love that, like, yeah, there's a bureaucracy. That's how you have to run an empire.
Yeah, and I like the mucking about part, right? Like, we get to see yet another wacky plan, mm-hmm. the world of Star Wars, go off flawlessly, where, like, Chopper and Ezra make a commotion, which prompts the pilot to say, okay, all droids to the back of the bus, including 3PO, mm-hmm. your translator droid. And then Sabine saying, like, oh, I'm a young Imperial Academy student, and I can translate for you. I got this. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. It, real fun. But yeah, I agree. I also, like, I don't know, the idea of, like, from a outside perspective of, I'm glad there are more women in power mm-hmm. in media. I think it's good. I also, it's weird to say it about the Empire, right? Because, like, they're the baddies. So right. them being misogynist doesn't necessarily rub me the wrong way in that, like, we can hold it up there to critique it and, like, have it be right. this, like, yeah, the Empire is this misogynist, racist agency. They are mm-hmm. bad. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the criticism of the misogyny has been less about the Empire and more about the creators of Star sure. Wars just yeah. not putting enough people in those positions mm-hmm. and not having them visible.
And, so. And kind of the idea that, like, you know, oh, but, like, they're, like, the women should be the good guys in this, you know? Like, which is, like, it's on the one hand, like, you know, it's not that we want, like, yeah, just it just one more kind of, like, sexist assumption there. But yeah, I also agree with you that it's one of those, like, oh, yay, diversity of terrible people. Good, like, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Seeing like, more women in roles, great. But yeah. The idea of the Empire not having women in leadership roles also does not rub me the wrong way, as long as we're getting that representation elsewhere in the series. And yeah, like, I'm not necessarily saying that, like, ah, yes, women have to be the good guys and we can only portray them in positive light. Like, we can have fun mm-hmm. female baddies too. It's just, like, yeah, I don't think necessarily the Empire needs to be an egalitarian organization.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. All right, any other last comments on that? Should we move on to the second episode?
Just want to add, you know, watching this relationship between Governor Price and the minister will be interesting going forward, because the, you know, governor in our world, we think of as a, you know, a government position. But in mm-hmm. Star Wars, in the Empire, it's actually kind of a pseudo-military position.
Right.
You know, Tarkin is referred to both as Grand Moff and Governor. So it is still, like, a part of the Imperial military hierarchy, so it's not a civilian position, where I believe the right. minister is. And, like, I think we also introduced the senator for the sector later on, which is a civilian position.
And I think that is, it's a, you know, our use of the word governor as, like, an elected political official is actually somewhat newer, mm-hmm. you know, in, like, the 18th and 19th centuries, especially, and well, and even into the 20th, mm-hmm. for a lot of, like, empires, especially the British, I know, but I think there's probably a translated version similar to governor in other languages. But, you know, like, India had a governor general, and, right. like, the Bahamas had a governor, and, like, different African colonies had a governor, who were all English people appointed by Britain to, like, help rule over the local authorities, you know? And so, yeah, to me, that's very much the energy I get. I think you're right. It's a very good point. Like, this is not, it might be someone from the planet, but it's very much a, like, handpicked by the Empire. So let's talk about episode 4, Fighter Fight. which I think is kind of a interesting pun because it's supposed to sound like fight or flight, fight or flight. So the plot is the episode focuses heavily on Ezra Bridger and Garazeb Aurelius, who are sent on a supply run after constantly arguing with one another aboard the Ghost. During their mission, they steal an Imperial TIE fighter, as it's actually called an Imperial TIE/IN Space Superiority Starfighter, and are ordered by Hera and Kanan to return to the Ghost. Along the way, they discover that a family of farmers, including Bridger's old friend Morad Sumar, have been arrested by the enemy. The two rebels rescue the farmers and fight the Imperials. After hiding the TIE fighter, they return to the Ghost, having become better friends for the experience.
Yay.
Friendship. I like that this episode picks up right where the previous episode left off, but still remains its own isolated story.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, I think it's fun. I think in some ways this is kind of the least impactful of the three episodes we're talking about today. But it's fun, you know, and it's a fun little kind of buddy cop. But it's a fun little buddy show, you know. It's the two of them getting to have some shared experiences, getting to connect with little each other. And also kind of showing that they're, like, Zeb feels much more adult. But, you know, we don't know how these species work. And him, Ezra, and Chopper are really the kids, you know, and Hera and Kanan are mom and dad. And I like kind of establishing that aspect of it.
Yeah, like Zeb feels like the older brother who maybe like his room's in the basement, but and he's got like a bit of authority. But yeah, I mean, like I think Hera and Kanan even say something like, oh, it's nice that the kids are gone. It's like, it's quiet now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I wrote in my notes, Chopper is a talented toddler who loves mischief. Like, delightful. He just is. There's a clear, like, Zeb's the older brother, Ezra's the middle, and Chopper's the youngest brother.
Yeah.
Or whatever gender he is.
Yeah, Chopper's the youngest sibling. Sabine is, like, I don't know, maybe a cousin who comes and stays with him for the holidays. Yeah.
Yeah. I did also like, you know, because, again, they're not making a big deal of it, but Ezra clearly trying to impress Sabine and Sabine having no interest in it. It was just like a fun little dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah. So we get to see some of Sabine's art, which is really cool. Like Zeb and Ezra are fighting over, I mean, Zeb's obviously real upset about Lasat and being reminded of that and his interactions with Kallus earlier. And Ezra's all like, I saved your life. You owe me everything. Sometimes, like, you'd have to be my butler, right? Mm-hmm. And Zeb is not in the mood for that.
But well, yeah, and they also have to be bunkmates, which this used to be just Zeb's room, so he's not happy about that.
And he just wants some, like, alone time, but he can't, well, yeah, he can and does lock Ezra out of his room, but Ezra, you know, takes offense to that. And then, yeah, Chopper decides now is a perfect time for a prank, pranks it so that Ezra falls on Zeb.
Yeah, he removes the bolts from the bunk bed.
Yeah, that's it.
And so when Ezra jumps on his bed, it falls down on top of Zeb.
Yeah. And I like the Hera sends them on a bit of a wild goose chase, asking them to get a Maluran fruit, which is apparently extraordinarily rare to find on the Lasat.
Lothal.
Yep. Sorry.
It's a little confusing. They gave us two syllable names starting with L.
Yeah. And Kanan and Kallus. I'm gonna get those two mixed up at some point. Just you wait. But yeah. I mean, it's like it's tropes that we've seen before, but it still feels really fun and fresh in this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed this episode a lot, and it continues my. I like the way that they use TIE fighters in these episodes where it's actually like a legitimate military weapon.
Right.
And can cause some damage as opposed to just like the pew-pew like space battles where they constantly get shot down and look unimpressive. When Zeb and Ezra steal the TIE fighter in this episode, it feels like a real thing, like they've stolen an actual military thing.
Right. Well, it does, except for the one objection that I have, and I've always kind of gotten the sense, but this is where it's fully confirmed for us. Like, when I think of spaceships, I think of, like, sensors and displays and things like that. Here, it is made abundantly clear that the glass in front of a pilot in like an X-wing and in a TIE fighter, and probably therefore also an X-wing or an A-wing or whatever, is just a glass window like a fighter pilot would have. Mm-hmm. And like when they get a whole bunch of gunk on the front of their window, they can't see out of it. And like, actually, even fighter pilots in the world today have like better radar and stuff that they do here. It's just funny to me sometimes how low tech part of this high tech world can be.
Yeah.
And I definitely had the like, how is it that like a TIE fighter doesn't have windshield wipers? Like, come on. Yeah, you know?
Well, also, I mean, like, it's like the MacGuffin to set up Ezra using the Force to get around an obstacle you can't see. But I mean, it's also like, this was their first time in a TIE fighter. Maybe there is a fancy display and they just don't know how to bring it up. But yeah,
that's fair. But even, you know, you mentioned radar. I don't know that radar is that good that it can just tell you that there is a mountain in front of you, like, or a building in front of you, right? Like, radar is a very specific device that you use to mostly to detect other metallic objects, right? Like other fighters.
Right.
And even like how much stuff, I guess meteors. I was going to say, how much stuff do you expect to be in your way if you're mostly flying through space? But there's junk. There's junk all up in there.
But also maybe this explains why TIE fighters crash so much.
There we go.
There you go. That could well be it.
I thought you were going to say, why doesn't the hatch lock? Because, there's an Imperial agent in there and Zeb just goes and like opens the door and is like, hello, this is my TIE fighter now.
Yep. It's like the AT-ST in Return of the Jedi. Like the Ewoks just open it up and get inside. Like, lock your doors.
Or just lock it, or maybe don't leave the key in the ignition all the time.
Also,
like,
also a good plan.
Like, there's an awful lot of ships that get stolen, and like, you know. Anyway, I think that's about all I had for that episode. Any other, is the fruit kind of makes for a fun little joke running through it. Any other kind of points you wanted to make about this episode, or should we go on to the third?
I wanted to quickly talk about the friend of Ezra's parents, the farmer, Sumar, and his wife and their farmhand. So yeah, they run into him at the market while looking for other items, like the Mealy Run fruit, and then also for realsies items that they need. And yeah, we find out that he's a friend of Ezra's parents, not necessarily Ezra. So we get like a little hint that, okay, like Ezra's parents were around, they're not anymore, and just get to go a little bit into that. And then they get taken by the Empire because the Empire wants the land of the Sumar's farm, and he's like, I'm not selling it to you. And they're like, oh, we're not buying it anymore. And like, just kidnap them basically. And then, yeah, they use the TIE fighter in what starts a beautiful trope of dress up like the bad guys and pretend you're one of them. They use the TIE fighter and like give an order to release the prisoners. The Empire doesn't buy it. And then they go and save them. And I think this idea of like Ezra no longer looking out for only Ezra is starting to form as well, which is nice.
Yeah, I think it's one more. It's just kind of reminding a tie-in that, like, Ezra had a family here and that the Imperial Alliance, like, the Imperial, like, impact is beginning to be felt by all these people in all these different places. And, yeah, that he's a little more willing to kind of step up. And also just nice to see him and Zeb forming the kind of connection that makes their relationship one that seems like antagonism of siblings instead of just two people who don't like each other.
Yes, yeah.
And big picture, like for this entire TV show, I like the way that they sprinkle crumbs in. Because like Sarah mentioning like that they knew Ezra's parents, like no spoilers about it, but that this is the kind of crumb that is going to pay off later.
There's like, I think it's a shocking amount of crumbs in this episode.
In the previous episode, the connection between Zeb and Callus over the genocide of Lasat is going to pay off. Like, it's going to get very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's another fun thing. All three of these episodes, I think there's a lot of little things that kind of just sprinkle through like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm just thinking, like, is it the whole series? Like, they I like the way that they return to things that
they had plans.
They either had plans or, like, seemed inconsequential, but it's like, okay, we remember from earlier in this episode, like, a lot of, not just Star Wars shows, like, a lot of just TV shows in general, I find, will do something in one episode and like contradict it a couple seasons later. And it's just a little thing. And so like, it's not a huge deal, but I like that like Rebels is being so conscious of what's come before, like the episodes that have come before, and like really building off of it and not trying to put in any of those
and building off of connections to other Star Wars franchises to, and, you know, having Bail be a part of this early on.
Right.
That's another sprinkle.
And doing stuff that also will be set up for things far into the future. You know, it feels very much like this is...
Oh, yeah.
It feels to me like, I think this was accurate, I kind of got the sense sometimes that Clone Wars was kind of seen as like the redheaded stepchild at Lucasfilms, and I say that as a redheaded stepchild. But, you know, it's just kind of like, okay, we're going to make that show for kids, and we'll throw in some stuff. But, like, it's not Star Wars quite the same. I don't think there's any of that with Rebels. I think it's very clear that, like, all the thinking about whatever stories we're going to tell in Star Wars in general... Rebels is a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, without really knowing the personnel dynamics, you know, within the Lucas Studios, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dave Filoni was part of Clone Wars and Rebels. It felt like Clone Wars was just, like, them giving him something and letting him do stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Rebels, it's like, okay, this is going to be a part of something bigger. Like, please come up with plans and, like, set stuff up.
Yep.
And yeah, like, it's, you know, The Mandalorian, there are connections to that show. It's going to be great for the next couple of years. So if you're here now, stay with us. We will tell you all about Rebels and these connections.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a good ride.
I think we're doing spoiler free from here on out. I mean, like, it's very late to be saying that right now, but
we'll wrap up a spoiler. We'll have a short spoiler section at the end of this, because there's definitely some stuff we're not saying.
Cool.
All right, well, so let's do episode 5 then.
Oh,
Rise of the Old Masters.
Hmm.
The episode features Ezra Bridger continuing his Jedi training with Kanan Jarrus, who worries he's not a good teacher for Bridger. The Rebels learn that Jedi Master Luminaria Unduli survived the destruction of the Jedi Order and attempts to rescue her from the Spire on Sturgeon Prime. However, they soon discover that it's a trap set by the Grand Inquisitor and that Unduli died with the Jedi Order. The Rebels escape, and Jarrus learns that he can be a good teacher for Bridger despite his previous doubts. I will also say that everyone in this episode would have had a much better time if they could just communicate directly.
What?
It's
being jammed.
I know. Anyway, what do you all think of this episode?
This episode is great.
Yes.
This is one of my favorites early on for a lot of reasons. There are many connections to other Star Wars things going on here. Stygian Prime in the comic books is a planet where Maul was imprisoned.
You know,
during the Clone Wars, he had the fight with Palpatine and was captured. And this is actually where he is imprisoned after that and then escapes from. So fun Maul connection there.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see a lot about Unduli in Clone Wars. She's just a minor character, but bringing her back is, I think...
Luminar Unduli was one of the Jedi Masters. She was actually the Jedi Master of Padawan.
Yeah, who was a big... And that was such a nice little reference. You know, they could have just picked some random Jedi we'd never heard of before, but they made it one who we have an emotional connection to from the Clone Wars.
Yeah, and I think especially... surrounding this idea of Kanan being a good teacher, right? Because, like, he's like, oh, I'm going to give you to Unduli. She's the best. She's going to be a super-duper great teacher, even though, like, her Padawan betrayed the Jedi Order.
Right?
And, like, it caused Ahsoka to leave the Jedi, basically. Like, so the idea of Luminara being a great teacher is kind of questionable, and I think it's just, like, more reflective of Kanan's self-doubt than it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Kanan is not a very good teacher.
No.
Because at the beginning of this, they're training Ezra on top of the ghost while it's flying, like, very high up. And, you know, he falls off and Kanan has to use the force to lift him back up and like, barely does so before he runs out of juice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just like, why are you training on top of your ship so high?
There was one moment that I thought perfectly captured, like, the bad teaching that's happening here, which is where Kanan is just berating Ezra and telling him all the things he's doing wrong. And then he kind of caps it off by saying, and you're so full of self-doubt. Like, A, as you were just saying, Sarah, Kanan has a lot of self-doubt himself. And so I think there's some projection here. But also, like, you just told him all the reasons he's terrible. Of course he has self-doubt, you idiot. Like,
yeah.
But it's also understandable because...
Of course.
Kanan is just, you know, like, I think mid-20s, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mid to late-20s, yeah.
Yeah. And he never finished his own Jedi training, like, based on his age. You know, he's right. Not an actual Jedi, even a knight or a master, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's similar to the way Luke, you know, in Legends... always has doubts about his ability to train future Jedi because he his own experience of being trained was so bereft. You know, he got like a week on Dagobah with Yoda.
And I will say also referencing that, and this is kind of jumping ahead in the episode, but it's worth, kind of is one of the things I most wanted to talk about. I love that the episode starts with Kanan kind of making fun of the old idea from Yoda of do or do not, there is no try. Because I hate that idea. I think, like, trying is super important. And I love that they start with that, but that at the end, and they start with them kind of making fun of it, but then the end is Kanan saying, the problem is that I was trying to be your teacher. I won't do that anymore. I will just be your teacher. And, like, I get from the certain point of view of the mindfulness of it where it's coming from, but I was definitely disappointed that he, by the end, is, like, back on board with Yoda instead of recognizing, like, yeah, that's kind of a dumb idea and we're not going to do that anymore.
Yeah, like, it's good for a motivational poster, but by The Last Jedi, even Yoda had kind of, like, gone against his own sayings. Because when he's talking to Luke as a ghost, he tells Luke, you know, that failure is what, you know, we can teach our students the most. Like, they are they are what we grow beyond. Or something like that, right?
We are what they grow beyond.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I... so I like that they introduce it as, like, Kanan tells Ezra, do or do not, there is no try. And Ezra asks, what the heck does that mean? And Kanan just fesses up, like, I don't know, it's just something that my teacher said. I honestly have no idea. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, huh? And then he tells... When they're going into this mission to go rescue Luminara, it's like, try not to mess it up or something to that effect. And he goes, there was no try.
Yeah.
And that's, like, a great point to just say, like, okay, don't mess it up, right? Like, that's what do or do not, there is no try means. Mm-hmm. And, like, I get what you guys are saying with, like, putting in an effort is important, but I think it is the sort of motivational poster of believe in yourself. Don't try to do something. Do something. If you fail... that's fine, but just this idea of, like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to try instead of, like, oh, well, I'm going
to
do it.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess this is, it kind of gets to the idea of why, like, you know, all of our brains are different and there's never going to be one motivational phrase that works for everyone. Because for, like, I can totally see why that would be motivation. For me, what that would tell me is that anything that isn't complete success is failure. And that would tell me to never try, to never do it because I can't do it. Like,
oh, sure.
Because I'm the exact opposite. I'm like, if you tell me that what is important is that I try, and if I do my best, and then I don't need to be angry at myself if I don't get to a certain point, because at least I did my best and I can always do better tomorrow. Like, that's how I would be motivated. You know, Yoda would not work for me. But you're right. I think it definitely is it can work for some perspectives, to be sure.
I don't even, yeah. I mean, I totally get what you're saying. I definitely am, like, paralyzed by that a lot of the time, and it's taken like that. There was, like, a great thing I read, which is, like, if you, instead of, like, if you're gonna do something, do it right. It's like, if you're gonna, something worth doing is worth doing poorly, which is, like, a riff on something worth doing is worth doing right, which has taken me forever, because I was the same. Like, if I can't completely finish, if I can't do it correctly, I'm just gonna not do it there, and I'm going to fail this entire class because I didn't turn in the term paper, because it's not going to be the world's best term paper situations, which I've done multiple times. But yeah, I mean, I totally get why this is, like, a Jedi phrase, I guess is where I'm
But if you look beyond the poster phrase itself, like the context of the lesson on Dagobah, Luke, the X-Wing, Luke's X-Wing falls into the bog, and Yoda's like, use the Force to lift it up. And he's like, I guess I'll try. Mm-hmm. And that's when Yoda says a thing, because he recognizes that Luke's try, in his heart, he's already decided he's not going to be able to do it.
Right.
And so he says, do or do not, there is no try, to show him, like, you've already decided you're going to fail. Like, you have to decide you're going to succeed. And then when Yoda shows him and lifts the X-Wing up, and Luke says, I don't believe it, then Yoda that says, that is why you fail, because you didn't believe.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like, the bigger lesson has more context.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I think one of the things that I'm most interested in, and we're going to kind of keep track of going forward, is the extent to which Kanan is or is not, like, honoring the original Jedi teachings and what he's teaching Ezra. Because we already talked about, like, he has a deep attachment to Hera in a way that the Jedi would have said is no bueno. You know, and I think, and especially because I think you're absolutely right, Riki, that, and both of you, there is a very important lesson there. I guess part of why I push back against it so much is the idea of you just have to never doubt yourself. You have to be utterly sure you would do it. Kind of like Obi-Wan is utterly sure he could teach Anakin, you know, or like so many of the problems Jedi, with the Jedi. Yeah. The fall of the Jedi was in large part caused by their own hubris and their own feeling of like, we don't need to try. We know we can do this and not question it. And so, yeah, it's something we can go round and round about, but I just think I hated it, but I think especially as we talk about it more, I love it because it's just, yeah, this is the thing that Kanan was taught. And of course he's going to fall back on it even, and maybe he found some ways it makes sense, but also some ways it still doesn't. And we'll just keep wrestling with that as we go forward.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And I agree that like boiling it down to one motivational poster phrase is not good. Like that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the Jedi Order was for such a long, long time. Was like, we're this one thing, we've distilled it down to the one essential thing that we're all going to do, and it's very simple and bite-sized and we understand it. And then it's like, well, what about all these corner cases? What about all these situations? What about all the context to this? It's like, no attachment. Attachment means bad, right? Hate leads to anger, like all that stuff where, like, if the Jedi would have just, like you said, had less hubris, like, and... taking a step back and realized, okay, there are multiple different ways to do things.
You remember what, you know, Obi-Wan says to Anakin, only a Sith speaks in absolutes.
Yes.
Do or do not.
Phrase. There is no try. Yeah, right?
Yeah, but do or do not is also an absolutist phrase. Mm-hmm. There is no attachment. There are no attachments. There's only peace. Also an absolutist phrase.
No posters.
Yeah. Moving on to something different, I also thought that what they did with Luminara was just kind of one more way of setting the tone for this whole show because it was dark.
Oh, yeah.
Like, having us be excited, having them be excited that she might still be alive and then getting to see her and then realize it's just kind of like a ghost projection done by the Inquisitor in some way as part of a trap and that this has worked before. I just found it haunting. You know, and like, I know that that's not just Star Wars. Like, the YA of today is a lot more intense than the YA when I was a kid. And I'm sure every generation says that. And it's not a bad thing. I think it's great. But it's nice to see, you know, Rebels kind of keeping up with that.
Yeah, well, I think just, like, looking at the fact that Rebels is theoretically, like, it's rated lower than Clone Wars, if I believe. I think it's YA and then Clone Wars is rated. I might just be confusing Canadian ratings.
So, there's the HoloNet transmission, where the Empire's like, we're awesome. And then it's interrupted by Senator Gal Travis, who's like a rebellious senator. He's like, Luminara is still alive, we have to save her. And then it cuts back to the original Imperial HoloNews, and it ends with this very interesting phrase, where they say, like, the successful liberation of a planet by initiative Base Delta Zero. And I was really curious about this because it's like, what does that mean? So, strap yourselves in. Base Delta Zero is actually the code name for basically the elimination of a population, a planetary population, via orbital bombardment from Star Destroyers. So they are advertising it as the liberation of the planet when they're actually saying is that they destroy this planet, you know, pre-Death Star. Mm-hmm. Which makes you wonder, like, because it only takes a couple of Star Destroyers to do this. Like, why do you need a Death Star if a couple of Star Destroyers can level a planet with their turbo lasers?
The Death Star looks cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's, like, the difference between, like, eradicating sentient life on the planet versus literally destroying the planet, but, like, the rocks don't care either way, you know? Yeah, good.
Well, I was going to say that this phrase is actually going to come up a couple more times, like, not necessarily, like, forefront, like, similar to this in the background that they're going to mention mm-hmm. it. And I think, like, we've talked about in the past... especially with Clone Wars, the idea of propaganda. And this, to me, is like the quintessential military propaganda of the mm-hmm. Empire, is that they destroyed a population. But they're like, yeah. Yay, us! Like, we helped these people. And that's the story that they are telling to the galaxy.
Right. And that's, again, not made up. Like, language like that was used by us in Vietnam. It's always been used by conquering or oppressing peoples, you know? I think that's it's really relevant there. Is there anything else from this episode we wanted to touch on, or should we jump into the spoiler section before we wrap up for the day?
I mean, can we talk about the Grand Inquisitor and how amazing the plan of a character and villain he is in this episode? Just, the way that he's drawn and presented is so menacing. And then, like, mm-hmm. when he reveals his lightsaber, like, this is the first time we see the Grand Inquisitor's lightsaber. It is a disc, I guess, is what I would call mm-hmm. it.
And yeah, it's like it's a rotating thing, and so we can make the whole thing spin around.
It's two-bladed, but unlike Maul, it's like it's still just a small hilt that you can hold in one hand, and the two blades come out of both sides, and then it starts spinning. Mm-hmm. And he's just, like, spinning it in front of him, kind of like a shield.
Yeah.
And advancing. It's just terrifying.
I love that he never runs after Kanan and Ezra. Like, he's walking quickly towards them, which is extra, extra menacing.
Yeah, you compared it to Resident Evil.
Yeah,
Mr. X,
yeah, who is, like, if I don't know if you're familiar with the Resident Evil games, just follows you at a set pace, and, like, while you do mm-hmm. your thing, he's, like, going, he's always walking, and if he catches
he's invincible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one, but I definitely have seen, I think that's a little bit of a trope, but not a bad one, of just, like, the villain who is so confident mm-hmm. that they're gonna just stride after you because they know they'll catch you. I also think it's fun that, there was an ad that was done by Tom Hiddleston and a bunch of other British actors who often play villains about, like, how Americans just go crazy for villains with British accents. And I don't know the exact Inquisitor's accent. I think it's British. Maybe it's, like, Australian or something like that. But it's definitely – it just adds to the menace of that character, you know? And it just makes him feel like he's on just such a different level than Kanan and Ezra.
And the voice actor, I believe, Jason Isaac or Isaacs, has done a lot of voice acting work. He's been, like, Lex Luthor mm-hmm. in one of the mm-hmm. movies, and, like, Sinestro in another. So he has a very large catalog of villainy.
And if it's Jason Isaacs, live action folks will know him as Lucius Malfoy from Harry Potter, among other things, as well as the first captain of the Discovery in Star Trek, or one of the captains of the Discovery in Star Trek Discovery, mm-hmm. where he also plays a kind of very interesting, like, morally interesting character. Thank you definitely for bringing that one up. And I think the Inquisitor is another character that we're really excited to see as we go forward.
And the way that he, like, is not only attacking Ezra and Kanan with his lightsaber and the Force, but also with his words and his ideas. Mm-hmm. He's trying to drive them to despair. He's trying to turn them to the dark side. It's just a great scene.
Yeah. Really true. Really true. And especially it's nice to have, like, it just kind of introduces this idea for both Ezra and Kanan of, like, the Jedi are not on equal footing to the Sith. Mm-hmm. Like, they are just, you are on the run, you are hiding, and even just this one person is just so overwhelming to you that it just sets up just how much they're hunted in this really great way.
Yeah, well, and, like, Ezra and Kanan are sharing one lightsaber between them, whereas, mm-hmm. the Inquisitor has a double-bladed weapon, right? Yeah, this highlighting, like you were saying, this unequal footing.
Yeah. So I think that's a good place to wrap up. Why don't we do like a, I'm going to do a quick ending session though for anybody who wants to hear the spoiler section. We'll go into that in just a few minutes. As always, Ricky and Sarah, thank you all so much for being a part of this. People want to follow you and the stuff you're doing, or even if they have some holiday shopping to do as they realize that some shipping containers are not going to arrive on time. I think one of you might have some ideas for that. Where can they find your stuff?
Okay, well, I guess I'll go first since, yeah. My Etsy store is live again. It's Hayashi Ceramics. So if you search like etsy.com/shop/Hayashi Ceramics, I've got some little ceramic pumpkins on there. 'Tis the spooky season. And I'll be having some other giftable things closer to, winter holidays. Yeah. And I also have an Instagram page, Sarah Hayashi Art. Yeah, that's where you can find me.
I have nothing to sell except my ideas.
Winning personality.
But you can follow me on Twitter at Wikipedia Go, where I talk about Pokemon Go.
Look, I feel like you're trying hard to sell people on Pokemon, and you don't quite have me buying, but I can see why some other people would be convinced. Well, and of course, you can find more about my podcasts, both this one, Superhero Ethics, as well as the Marvel Movie Minute, where we're covering Thor, all at theethicalpanda.com. We always want feedback. You can send that in to The Ethical Panda on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us at theethicalpanda@gmail.com, or of course, go to the website, again, ethicalpanda.com, and just fill out the contact form there. Love feedback. We always want to know what you're thinking. How do you feel about these characters? It can be spoiler or not spoiler, up to you. Let us know what you think. And of course, this is just one of many podcasts on the Stranded Panda Podcast Network. Please check all of them out. Also want to give a quick note that I'm going to be on my honeymoon next week. We are, in just a few minutes, or later today, Riki and Sarah and I are going to record a second episode. So we'll have an episode during my honeymoon week to go up. I may not have an episode for the week after. We're not sure yet. But so if there is a one episode break, don't worry, we'll be coming back. I'm just enjoying a little bit of time off. So please check out all those great things. Check out Riki and Sarah's stuff. And if you don't want to hear the spoilers, then thank you so much for being a part of this. And for everybody who does want to hear spoilers, we're going to start that in 3, 2, 1. Oh man, is it hard to remember just how awful Kalos was.
I know. I love his redemption so much. Mm-hmm. But wow, he was not a good dude. But I think this really makes the payoff of Zeb taking him to see the like Lasat outpost at the end really pay off, because like the idea of like, oh, I destroyed them, and then like, oh, okay, I didn't destroy all of them, there is this like really considerably large outpost that made it out,
right
I'll pay off a little nicer. But yeah, yikes.
Yeah, and it's funny. I was just listening to another podcast that I'm becoming a huge fan of, that I would definitely recommend to both you two and to fans. It's called RuPaul's Pod Race. Like, it's a play on RuPaul's Drag Race, but it's RuPaul, as in Palpatine, and then Pod Race. And it's basically, it's five queer, huge Star Wars nerds talking about different Star Wars stuff. And on this most recent episode, they talk a lot about the Kanan Zeb relationship. I'm sorry, the yeah.
You did it. You did the thing I said I was going
to
do.
I know. Kalizeb, as I think it's referred to a lot in the Slash idea. And yeah, they talk about like just how much of a journey it is, and how it's, again, I think a real credit to the show is that even though I'm like reminded of just how evil he was, I do think it's earned. You know, like one of my biggest frustrations is something like Ben Solo or something like that, where I just don't feel the redemption is earned. And here it really, really is.
Mm-hmm. But I think that even here that they are setting it up to some degree. So the bow rifle that Kalos is using, I believe the specific phrase he uses is that it was given to me by a royal guardsman, right? When Zeb says only a royal guardsman carries a bow rifle.
And I mean, given to him or taken?
Well, I think he says given, and the implication is that, like, I murdered this guy.
Yeah.
But.
Mm-hmm. But the, I just looked it up real quick. There's like a right, I guess, like a dying right for the Lasat warrior. That you do give your weapon to the person who defeated you in honorable combat. So, like, it's presented menacingly, just like, I took this from a dead royal guardsman, right? But even here, like, the way that he phrased it, I think is still setting up this future where we learn a little bit more about Callus and that he perhaps like did have respect for their culture in a weird way.
Wait, like the low-key Thrawn school of thought of like study the art, learn the folks, but
I don't remember that, but it's entirely possible, and so that'll be really exciting to see as we come to that. What other things kind of stood out for you in from a spoiler perspective?
Gal Travis, which hopefully we cut out of the regular
episode. Sorry for all the editing, Matthew.
The senator who interrupts the Imperial Holonews program is actually an Imperial agent who is basically setting people up. Because this is, like, very sus, right? Like, Gal Travis is like, Luminara is still alive. Like, go rescue her. And it's like, nope, it was a trap. And I think we're in this episode, they mask it in a way that's like, oh, the Inquisitor, like, tricked Travis.
Okay.
But once you know that, you're like, oh, yeah, this guy was totally in on it all along.
Yeah, I think part of the wonderful editing Matthew had to do is me just saying that they outed him in this episode, which, thanks for bringing it up, that they don't. They end up meeting with the Gal Travis later. But yeah, when the Inquisitor says, like, we've been luring people in for a long time. This is our go-to trap. I think either, like, I knew he was bad already and my mind went there, or, like, I think in the initial watch through, I was like, oh, well, the interrupty guy is bad. Because it was, like, again, like, very convenient timing. And also, how has the I mean, I don't know. Maybe the Empire is locking down its broadcast isn't top priority. But, like, the fact that these broadcasts keep going out and he keeps interrupting is, like you said, highly sus.
Yeah. For me, like, rewatching it with the knowledge, the part that didn't make sense to me was that this guy could still be a senator.
Yeah.
Well, and I know in episodes that we're going to watch for the next episode, he refers to himself as a senator in exile. I think the idea is that he was elected to his position. Yeah. And he still officially holds it, but he hasn't, like, or maybe, like, he still claims it, but I don't think he's definitely not going to Senate meetings or anything like that.
I think he refers to himself as senator as exile in this transmission, too. But yes,
hold new elections, then.
Hold new elections.
Elect a new senator.
Yeah. Well, there might be a new senator, and it's like the multiple pope situation where they're all the senator. Yeah.
And it's interesting because, I mean, maybe I just was not paying attention as much. But the first time, I definitely didn't pick up on the susness. Like, I got I was a little suspicious of the situation in general. But I remember being kind of surprised when we do find out that he's a double agent. So it's just fun to watch it again and be like, oh, yeah, now that I know it, I can see how well they planted those seeds. But at the time, certainly I missed it.
It's hard to get back into the mindset of, like, when I first watched this. And I think there's, like, the tendency to think, like, I was more wise to the things than I was. But yeah, I mean, even this one, I still got excited. I was like, oh, Luminara is alive. Yay, she made it. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Because, they do set up that, like, you were talking about earlier, this, like, hope of, like, woohoo, we're not alone. Here's another Jedi. This is so great. We're going to make friends and allies. We're going to band together. Never lose hope. Like, there were rumors that she made it out alive. The rumors are true. Hooray. Yeah, and then to get there, and she's not there. She's dead. You see her corpse. It's just, like, so crushing. And it was even crushing this time, knowing that it was happening. Like, yeah. And it's, I think we were also talking earlier in the part that Matthew cut out. Thank you. That... like the ratings for this show, like this seemed a lot more cutting than anything that happened really in Clone Wars, maybe at least a lot darker. And this is a lower rating age wise than Clone Wars. I guess it's rated Y7 and Clone Wars is rated PG, and it's just, I don't know.
I think it's interesting.
One of the things you have to watch for in terms of those ratings is the violence. How do they depict the violence, especially like lightsaber fights? Like, do they actually show anyone like slicing someone, which they did in Clone Wars, right? Like, we saw some of that.
And the ratings themselves make so little sense, in terms of, like, you can have like quite a lot of blood and gore, and as long as you don't say the F word and there's only like a certain number of seconds that a nipple is on screen, you're fine. You know, it's just such idiocy.
No, all right. I agree. Yeah.
just has me all the more hyped up for our next episode. So anything more you want to say before we wrap up spoilers?
Yes. Well, one more thing about the Inquisitor, which is spoilery enough. I love that in the duel, he immediately recognizes Kanan's master. He's like, while fighting, he's like, ah, this is the style of Master Depa Bulava.
Mm-hmm.
Bulava, I think. And it's, as we learn later, like, that's true. And then we saw that in the beginning of the Bad Batch,
mm-hmm.
when, at the time, Caleb and his master were attacked by the clones in Order 66. So, I don't know if, like, they knew that at the time they wrote this episode, but it's just a fun little thing. And, again, shows the menace of the Inquisitor and his depth of knowledge.
Definitely. Definitely. And that's something we're going to keep track of in the next couple episodes. So, well, as always, Riki, Sarah, thank you all so much. To all of our fans, thank you. Please let us know what you think of all this. Please check out these other podcasts and the other creations that we're all making. And have a good day.
Womp, womp, womp.